Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger. The president of Columbia University, Manoush Shafiq, has resigned.
She faced sharp criticism in her handling of campus-wide protests of the Israel-Hamas war that became a national symbol, including allegations that she didn't do enough to protect Jewish students on campus and later bruising criticism in an appearance on Capitol Hill. Presidents of Harvard University and the University of Pennsylvania have also previously resigned in the wake of protests on their campuses.
ABC's Lindsay Davis. Vice President Harris will be joined by President Biden tomorrow at a campaign event in Prince George's County, Maryland, where they'll talk about their work to lower costs for Americans. Hurricane Ernesto could be Category 3 strength by the time it reaches Bermuda. It left damage and flooding to Puerto Rico, where nearly half of the island is without power. Award-winning actress Jenna Rollins has died at the age of 94. Stocks closed higher today. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Voter turnout Tuesday in Wisconsin's fastest growing county was 45%. That's the highest for a fall primary in Dane County in 40 years. Democrat Kelda Royes represents Madison in the state Senate.
You know, Wisconsin is always a swing state. It is on a knife's edge. So I don't think that anybody should be feeling overconfident. But I do think that all the facts point to the election trending blue.
Turnout in Wisconsin's other big blue county, Milwaukee County, was 33%. 16 Republican state lawmakers won their primaries easily Tuesday. The closest races are won by Paul Tittle, who took nearly 60% of the vote, and Chaz Green and Karen Hurd, who won 57%. WisPolitics reports insiders expected more of an anti-incumbent wave. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News.
A lot of us were alive to remember. For some, it's just legend. The 1982 Brewers World Series run. Join us this Thursday, noon to 2 on the Allball Show as we welcome Kelly Call, producer, and Sean Hannish, director and producer of Just a Bit Outside, the story of the 82 Milwaukee Brewers. We're giving away 4 tickets to the Brewers game and 4 tickets so you can be at the world premiere on September 13th. Join us on Thursday.
The Todd Allball Show, weekdays noon till 2. Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Maybe on Monday you were one of the people who didn't get through to watch the or listen to the Elon Musk interview of Donald Trump. Oh boy, two guys who are billionaires telling us on how working people should lead their lives. It was an interesting, I spent about an hour. It's all I could do. I tried to do more. Could not, because Musk is really hard to listen to, and Trump is even harder to listen to. So when you have two people who are really not interesting to listen to, kind of monotoning their way through self-aggrandizing statements of, it was almost like they were stuttering and stammering and tripping over each other to try and shove each other's heads up the other's behind and blow smoke. That's kind of what it was. It was a billionaire love fest, only in one tone. And there's been a lot of things that, you know, that Trump rattled on about it. And the more I listen, the more I go, well, one, needs new material. Two, wow, this is the guy that they want to have president. And three, working people, listen to what he says. You know, we've been saying on this program for a while, Trump is no friend of workers, especially unionized workers. And during the discussion with the Tesla CEO, Trump said to Elon, "You're the greatest cutter." And what he was talking about is, you know, the workers at Tesla we're striking. And Trump said, well, you just walk in and you just say, you want to quit? You want to go on strike? He said, I won't mention the name of the company, but they go on strike and you say, that's okay. You're all gone. Every one of you, you're gone. And it kind of pairs with the Trump tagline of you're fired. So the message that they're sending is, look, you working people, you'll get what we give you. It's kind of like what we used to tell our kids when they were younger. You'll get what you get and don't throw a fit. This is what the employer class, what the billionaire class is telling the plebs who create their profits. Now, fortunately, the UAW, they filed federal labor charges on Tuesday saying, look, you know, you're violating the law by doing this, because under federal law, you can't be fired for going on strike. And threatening to fire someone for going on strike is also illegal under the National Labor Relations Act. Now, what are you going to do to them? That's the question. You've got these two clowns talking about how to fire workers and how wonderful he is. What's interesting is the whole little conversation was done on the Twitter or the X that Musk has screwed up. Major technical problems. You know, I think it was like 45 minutes late that they started because they were having mass tech issues and didn't get enough people. Yeah, there's a whole to-do. And you go, this is what happens when you fire 60, 70% of the workers and try and make profit off of something that you're destroying. But for my union friends, and this is where I go, at some point you have to look at the words that come out of their mouths. You have to look at the intention behind the words. You're all fired. He just went in there and they're all gone. They didn't listen to him. That makes him great. He's the greatest cutter, the greatest cover. Now, stop and think about this for a second. If Trump were to win, imagine Elon Musk as the Secretary of Labor. Imagine I had someone, you know, tell me that I made a mistake in saying that Sean O'Brien, the president of the Teamsters, may want to be Secretary of Labor. Trump would never appoint anyone from labor to that position. Musk would be an interesting thing. And I look at O'Brien's RNC speech, which I came out vigorously opposed to. And for that, I have paid a price with my Teamster friends. That's the cost of being on the right side. That's the cost of standing up in opposition of power and saying that this is a mistake. And every time one of these issues like this pops up, you have to bring up the fact that that RNC speech is not going to age well. And I said it the day he gave it, it's not going to age well. These are the people who want to destroy organized labor. These are the people who want to destroy collective bargaining. These are the people who want to destroy prevailing wage. These are the people who want to destroy project labor agreements. These are the people who want to destroy federal unions. These are the people who want to not raise the minimum wage, actually get rid of it entirely and move us back to a desperate and poverty-ridden era. And we've talked at length about the Lochner era, where the federal government could pass no law that infringed on the rights of business and employers. No minimum wage laws, no maximum hour laws, no safe working condition laws, no child labor laws, none of that stuff. So when I hear two billionaires having this love fest about, you know, how they're going to reshape America to benefit them, this is the stuff that I'm talking about. And to have any union, which is really interesting that we haven't heard much from Sean O'Brien since the RNC debacle. I've been waiting for something. It tells me, I think even he knows it was a mistake. And there's a moment where you go, yeah, we miscalculated. Now understand, Trump is an anti-union guy. He said it before. It's on tape. He supports right to work. And look, I support the idea of people having a right to work, a right to a job, a right to a decent wage, a right to health care, a right to retirement security, the right to safe working conditions, actual, real, tangible rights. Not this fantasy right to work where all it really is a destruction of your ability to join and form unions, which again, Project 2025 is fairly clear on. So you have these two billionaires just waxing poetic, and then you have the written document of this Project 2025, which we've been talking about on this show for months now. Well before the mainstream media picked up on it, well before any politician uttered it, we were talking about how this was going to make patronage great again, and this was going to harm working people. And here we are, finally. People are waking up to the reality that Donald Trump is not the friend of working people. Because I've asked time and time again, what did he do during his tenure as president? What did he do in the hours he was in the Oval Office to move the standard of living for working people? Well, Wall Street was doing well. Wall Street's doing well now. They're fat and happy. They seem to always be. They always seem to get what they need. It's working people. It's the people who punch a clock every day and collect a paycheck at the end of the week. They're the folks who are struggling. They're the ones who are falling behind because inflation, because of corporate greed, is eroding their standard of living, and they don't have the bargaining power to go out and fight for better wages to keep up with that inflation. This, for me, again, another reason that the Trump agenda is horrible for working people, and that we should be talking about the policies of Joe Biden, who history, as I've been saying, is going to look incredibly positive on. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. When we come back, Colin Seaberger is going to be here from the Center for American Progress to share some thoughts on the Project 2025.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I go back to the you're fired guy, claim to fame. You're fired. That guy, and then the guy who fired workers having a little chat about how wonderful it is to when workers go on strike, you fire them. They're all gone. That was Trump's comment, right? And for me, I look at where we're heading. Could be disaster, could be continuing on the right path. November's a very interesting decision time, especially when working people should have all the information in front of them. They're not lying to us. They're not saying we're going to do wonderful things. They're telling us what they're going to do. Trump and company are very clear. If anything, probably the only time in Trump's life that he's ever been honest. This is it. That's why I've asked Colin Seaberger to come talk with. He's a senior communication advisor there at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. They got a new piece out on Project 2025 and the plan to gut the checks and balances and harm American workers. Colin, thanks for taking time for us.
It's great to chat with you.
So, let's start where I began. They're not lying. They're laying out in detail, in excruciatingly painful detail, exactly how they want to change this country, and exactly what they want to do to working people. I got to tell you, I don't know where to go with that other than we know what's coming, And if you vote for it, we're going to get what we deserve.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a real contrast in visions between, you know, one that really seeks to, like you said, dismantle the system of checks and balances to give, you know, politicians, judges, corporations more control over Americans' everyday lives. You know, what we see in things like Project 2025 is a tax plan that would increase taxes on the typical American family by nearly $3,000 a year. And, you know, when you couple that with, you know, other changes that they're proposing to make, like making it harder for workers to receive the overtime pay that they, you know, have earned, or pulling the rug out from workers and being able to organize for better wages and working conditions and benefits, by, you know, limiting the use of card check, dismantling the watchdog role of the National Labor Relations Board, and fundamentally, you know, giving states unprecedented power to basically ban unions altogether, and ban public employee unions outright. So it is definitely, you know, a dark picture that is, you know, being painted by these far right extremists. And then, you know, we see this progressive vision where, you know, we're talking about giving middle class families more, you know, more of their hard earned money, giving them a middle class tax break, doing things like expanding overtime eligibility, like we've seen the Biden administration do recently, or supporting workers in their efforts to organize and have their unions recognized.
No, and I think that last one's the big part for me, because I hear people every day complaining about inflation. And look, inflation is hurting, especially low-wage and middle-income working families. I get that 100%. But the reality is, if you had bargaining power to increase your wages at a sufficient rate to keep up with inflation, it wouldn't be as harsh. And I go back to my grandparents' generation. You know, the 1970s for my grandparents, you know, they went through hyperinflation. They went through the whole stagflation thing. But 1975, my grandfather got three raises in that year because his union contract had a cost of living adjustment that if inflation went up a certain percent, wages kept up, so that your wages and your standard of living didn't get eroded by inflation. And for me, this is the part that I don't know that we're spending enough time talking about, on how we curb some inflation, how we help working families make it through. And I don't know that we're talking enough about that. I know the Republicans are. I think Donald Trump and Elon had their little fire them all. I don't know we're talking about enough about that.
Well, you know, I think that we're going to see a real proof point this week. On Thursday, President Biden and Vice President Harris are going to be announcing the results of the first, you know, 10 drugs that were eligible for Medicare negotiation. They're set to announce what those lower prices are going to be. You know, this is, you know, prescription drugs and healthcare is like a lot of things, whether you look at childcare, you look at housing, what have you. These are not recent things that have been stressing people's finances, right? These are problems that have been, you know, plainly obvious to any, you know, typical American family for a long time, right? And we are starting to chip away at them, you know, like I said, the prescription drug costs. But think about the changes that we've made over the course of decades, like the Affordable Care Act, you know, helping give families more relief in those healthcare premiums. There's more work that we need to do, of course, but, you know, there is one vision for how you make life more expensive, like increasing taxes on middle-class families being put forward by the far right. And there's another vision about, you know, making childcare more affordable, investing in families and making sure that they have the tax relief that they need in order to be able to, you know, afford that cost of living that is holding too many people back. So it is a real clear contrast, and it's one that I think, you know, as we're seeing more and more people, you know, becoming aware of what's in this far right authoritarian playbook Project 2025, we're seeing that people are responding very negatively to it. And, I think that's only going to increase in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, you brought up childcare, which I think Project 2025 has a brilliant childcare plan, doesn't it? why put kids into an environment where they might read books and play and have a childhood when we can put them back to work? I mean, they've got small hands, they can do little intricate stuff, they can get into those machines where adult hands can't get. So this is that not childcare in the 18th century?
It may be, I was not alive then, Rick, I hate to disappoint, but that is essentially what Project 2025 lays out. And that is to go back to the Gilded Age when corporations had the power to exploit the labor of people, including children. And essentially what Project 2025 proposes is instructing the Department of Labor to issue new regulations to allow children to work in dangerous jobs. It's incredibly harmful, and it's incredibly frightening, given the fact that we've been seeing kind of an increase of child labor violations, over the course of the past 5 years, if you look at the data. And that's partially responsible because we've seen, states under MAGA control, are turning back the clock on child labor protections. But I do have to make a point here, and that is, you talk about childcare. Project 2025 proposes to eliminate entirely the Head Start program, which provides childcare for low-income families. How you think that you're supporting kids and how you think you're supporting families if parents aren't able to go to work so they can earn a living to support their kiddos just makes no sense to me.
Well, it makes perfect sense to me when you look at it from the when you put the red hat on and you let the red hat ink bleed into your brain, you get it, because it's not about your children to understand. It's about others' children. They're gonna get that education is wasted on them. Head Start's wasted on them. They need to go to work, and we need cheap labor. So we need the kids to be competing against mom and dad in the workplace to keep wages lower. And this is how families are going to get by. Instead of one income of the 1950s and 60s supporting a family, or two that the 70s, 80s, 90s, we're now into the three, possibly four income needed for a family to survive. And that's making America great again, back to the good old days of the Gilded Age or the robber baron era.
Yeah, I mean, I think a perfect example of this is the fact that, you got Project 2025 authors out there who are supporting plans to cut Social Security by raising the retirement age from 67 to 69. Essentially, this amounts to a massive benefit cut, up to $100,000 over the course of a decade for about 74% of Americans who would be impacted by that increase in the retirement age. So, I don't hear too many people out there who are saying, I don't need, a little extra breathing room during my retirement. I hear the exact opposite. It's just ludicrous that, these far right extremists are putting forward these ideas. When people are clearly begging for the exact opposite.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Colin. I mean, they've been saying this for years. This isn't new. I think didn't Nikki Haley want to take it up to 70? Haven't there been some, I forget who the congressman was. People want to work into their 80s. They love working into their 80s. Yeah, so to me, that's not new. They've always been the party of destroying Social Security. It's all of this other stuff that they've written down and, they've been saying this stuff to themselves in their think tanks and in the smoke-filled back rooms. This is the first time they've really come out with a comprehensive plan and go, we hate America as it is so much that this is our declaration of independence from reality.
If the left will allow it to remain bloodless, exactly. is what the head of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, who is taken over the reins of Project 2025. This is what he's promising. But again, I think that folks need to take this threat seriously because, again, this is fundamentally about changing how American government works by gutting the checks and balances in our government and allowing the, you know, power in our government to be consolidated in a single person, in the president, by doing things like replacing the civil servants with political loyalists, like, you know, using illegally using impoundment power to bypass Congress, or, you know, wholesale abolishing government agencies like the Department of Education, or, you know, stripping independent agencies like the Department of Justice, FTC, others from, you know, having some autonomy and independence from the president's individual power. That is really why Americans should take all of this seriously, is because, you know, if you dismantle these norms, you're really giving unprecedented power to, you know, folks who put an ideology first instead of the public interest.
I forget the woman who said, I think her name was Maya Angelou, who said, when they tell you who they are, believe them.
Yes.
I mean, this is them telling us and writing it down. This is like, you know, that kind of, you know, going before the police and writing your confession down. This is that kind of serious. And, you know, for any working person to know this exists and to go, this is the world that I want, is kind of frightening to me, because this really does repeal the 20th century, or at least that's my take on it. When they say they want to make America great again, I ask, when was it great? Where are we going back to? And for the Trumps of the world, for the Musks of the world, for our billionaire class, it's that, you know, the good old days of the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s.
Yeah, I mean, we know what, you know, left to their own devices, these, you know, corporate barons are promising, and that's really to pull the rug out from under, you know, working people in this country who are just asking to be, you know, fairly compensated and treated with dignity for their hard work. And that is, you know, that is what, you know, progressives are fighting for, is to make sure that, you know, people who put in hard work, you know, are able to be compensated for it. Yeah, and
it really is about a vision for the future, though. I mean, it's what kind of a country do we want to leave to our children? Because, you know, I find it interesting that a lot of my conservative friends yell and scream about, you may remember this phrase, activist judges. You look at our Supreme Court, activist justices, and they want to take this to the government level, to where, again, you use the word authoritarian, I'll use the word dictator. They want to create a little dictator in this country that can, you know, hire and fire and do whatever at their whim, basically making patronage great again.
Yeah, I mean, look, this radical MAGA Supreme Court has made very clear that there is no precedent that they're not willing to put in the shredder. Look at Dobbs. You know, a lot of people back in the middle of the last decade thought abortion rights are protected. They're not going away. And, you know, we saw how quickly that can change. But it's not just abortion. You look at, you know, recent rulings from the court on, you know, how government agencies are able to operate in the public's interest or not. And yeah, they made very, very clear, you know, who they're working on behalf of, and what, you know, how they approach kind of putting ideology above the actual rule of law.
Yeah. So if
it's why, you know, we shouldn't take for granted that, you know, a court that is, you know, very clearly aligned with the far right is going to be willing to stand up to some of these abuses in Project 2025 that they would try to implement.
So if cutting Social Security isn't bad enough, if destroying what we have has become the norm for overtime protection in this country is not enough, if destroying and undermining the ability of workers to join and form unions and collectively bargain isn't enough, if sending children into the workplace doing dangerous jobs isn't enough, how much worse does this get? I mean, do we go back and repeal all the 20th century protections on race and gender and discrimination? Do we make discrimination great again?
I mean, that's really what Project 2025 proposes, to make it harder to track civil rights violations and, you know, bring cases pursuant to Title VII, giving employers to, you know, basically unchecked ability to, act with impunity in terms of punishing people they disagree with. It is, it's really frightening.
November is right around the corner. Colin, I appreciate you taking time for us. Good stuff. Hope people will take a look at your latest report. We'll get links out on social media, AmericanProgress.org, the website, if you want to see Colin Seeberger's work. He's a senior communication advisor there. Colin, great talking with you. I appreciate the time. I'll look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Absolutely. Take care, Rick.
I'll tell you, this serious, you should read. It's keyworded. You can find the important things, education important to you. You can find a whole chapter on education, labor rights. It's all there. You just have to seek it out. And maybe we'll get links out on social media so you can check that out too. Quick break, right back.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Showers and thunderstorms tonight and tomorrow. Low tonight, upper 60s. High tomorrow, upper 70s. A stray storm and partly sunny Friday, high mid 70s. The weekend looks nice with sunshine, high low 80s Saturday, mid 80s Sunday. It's 69 degrees right now.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this Civic Media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous, unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of Civic Media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Monday, I did a piece on why I like Tim Walz so much and got a lot of email responses from people going, yeah, exactly. He's radically normal, which is, you know, what I've been saying. The guy is like your neighbor. And he's the guy who, you know, like my next door neighbor. I was away. My wife was pregnant with the kids. He came over and shoveled the snow out of the driveway. Nobody asked him to do it, just did it. In fact, we had to figure it out. That's the kind of guy that I want into political office. Someone who's going to be part of the community, care about their neighbors, do the good stuff that someone like Tim Walz, from what I'm seeing, can do. So the question becomes, and I've been saying this for a very long time, we need to be reaching out to working class voters in a bigger way, especially rural working class voters. That's why I was thrilled to see my friend Roger Kirsten put out a new piece over at barnraisingmedia.com or barnraisingmedia.com, asking that very question: can Tim Walz help Democrats win back rural America? Roger, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Rick. Always glad to join you for some conversation.
So an extremely important question, because it's been assumed for a very long time that Democrats just gave up on rural America. I mean, you know, Hillary and Obama have both, you know, said some things that can be taken as disparaging to rural America. Does Tim Walz give Democrats an inroad there?
Well, a lot of folks on this call certainly hope so. And I think I would. So this was at the request of the fine folks at Barn Raiser, and the website again is barnraisingmedia.com. I listened in on the Rural Americans for Harris call. I guess it was last Tuesday, the 6th. And as you know, there have been many of these. There was Black women for Kamala, and white women for Kamala, and white dudes for Kamala, and Black men for Kamala. This is a little bit smaller group. It was a couple thousand people, but it was rural organizers from Kentucky, Georgia, Mississippi, Ohio, a lot of different states, North Carolina, where rural voters will play, and Pennsylvania was represented. A lot of places where rural voters will play an important part in the election. And I would say the theme was show up, don't give up, that there are real opportunities there. There are voters, as you say, who are hurting. who could be receptive to a message about investing in communities, about bringing people together as opposed to dividing people. And they, like you, are very positive on Tim Walz's choice. The story is that Governor Walz had agreed to headline this call, and then he got nominated to be vice president, so he couldn't make it. So Peggy Flanagan, who's the lieutenant governor of Minnesota, came in to speak in his place, which she may have to do more than a few times in the next couple of months. And if he's successful, she will become governor of Minnesota and be the first Native American governor in the country's history, I think. So that's an interesting sideline as well.
Yeah, it is. But I look at Tim Walz and I look at the fact, and one of the reasons that I was pulling for him is that he does some of the things that, that I think Democrats need to do better. And that is, you know, ball up your digits and get in there and mix it up a little bit. You know, when a street fight breaks out, don't be the one that offers to hold their coat, but get in there and fight back. And I think Walz does that in a way that isn't as maybe as combative, but just as you know, strong and willing to fight as anyone else. I think rural voters are attracted to that kind of strength, and talking about it in a, you know, in a way that rural voters like me understand.
Yeah, I think I read a piece today that also, you know, he's got a pretty good occupational background for this. I mean, if you think Fox News is tough or Trump is tough or whatever, you try standing up in front of high school teenagers five days a week for 20 years. And part of his appeal is that he has a way to make his point without being offensive to the audience. He's a little bit self-deprecating. And, you know, he was on his feet. He was a football coach. He was a civics teacher. He understands issues. He understands how to relate and communicate to people. And as I say, the rural organizers who've been advocating for more resources and more attention to these communities are excited that he's a guy who can really help them. One of the things that I think sometimes gets overlooked is the connection between rural communities and manufacturing communities in small cities and towns. You know, in a lot of farm families, somebody's got a job and a paycheck and some health insurance from some place.
Right.
Even while they're trying to make the farm work. And that, I think, became even more true. Those of us with a little gray hair remember the 1980s. There was a farm crisis. A lot of people lost their farms and somebody had to go to work, get a paycheck coming. Well, when NAFTA and the unrestricted trade with China happened in the 90s and 2000s, then a lot of those jobs went away. Those factories closed. And there were communities in where, in the smaller cities that are in rural areas, there's kind of one plant in town, a plant like Maytag or paper mill. When that plant closes, there's nothing left, and people are really in a tough circumstances. So in 2016, when Donald Trump came on the scene, he was the first presidential nominee of a major party to campaign against free trade. He really found a that resonated in rural communities very, very strongly. They'd seen the job loss, they'd seen the pain. They were hopeful that this would be something new and different. And I think what rural Democrats are excited about as well, that didn't work out so well. He maybe talked a good game, but didn't really bring many solutions. Here's some folks who are listening and perhaps can bring some solutions.
No, this is what I've given Biden credit for, because, you know, 2022, we did our working class heroes tour, and we went to places that used to be. You know, places like you've laid out that used to have a factory there that was the anchor of that community, that brought revenue in, that generated, you know, the jobs that farmers may have needed for health insurance and the such. And what's happened to those places since, as you so eloquently laid out, we've lost those jobs. And then, you know, we want to do a tour this year about the places that are going to be the investments that have been made by the Biden administration, and where Harris and Walz can pick this up and move it forward, and why Walz, I think, is the right guy to be the number two there to help steer some of that, having that firsthand experience of seeing those communities go through the pain and the suffering of losing that anchor, and then the problems that come along, and then hopefully having some of those solutions. So I think as a salesman, he could be a real positive for Democrats in reclaiming, like you said, those rural Democrats that left because the factories left.
That's what the hope was. And there's a lot of, you may remember what Howard Dean used to call the 50 state strategy, which the Democrats can't be afforded to be absent anywhere. And I heard a lot of echoes of that in speakers on this call. If you think of swing states. Well, maybe I'm in a red county in North Carolina or in Pennsylvania or in Michigan. And if I run for something, maybe I don't have that good of a chance of winning. But if there's a candidate there, at least there'll be somebody to turn out. And then votes can go to Harrison Waltz, and we've got a Senate race here, and so on. And I've been looking for another story I'm working on. I've been looking at voting results in some rural Michigan counties. I'm based in northern Michigan. And there's counties where there's no Democratic candidate for prosecutor or sheriff or register of deeds or any of those countywide offices, which are significant offices in terms of people's daily lives. But Democrats feel like they just don't be competitive, so they don't run anywhere. And the message of this call was, hey, we've got a top of the ticket can really speak to some of these voters. Let's get out there. Maybe the 60-40 race will only be 55-45, but that extra 5%, boy, that can really help put some candidates we care about over the top.
Yeah. No, I mean, your statewide candidates, especially here in a place like Pennsylvania, where, Democrats have historically just looked to Philadelphia. If we get a good turnout in Philadelphia, we're going to do okay. Good turnout in Pittsburgh, and forget about the T and the rest of the state. And Republicans have had free reign, at least in my state. So to hear this, music to my ears, because something we've been screaming about here on this program for, 19 years now, to get in there and like I said, mix it up a little bit, because Democratic ideas are good ideas, and they're good for, urbanites, they're good for rural suburbanites, they're good for American workers, and they need to tell that story better and not shy away from it.
There's that piece of it. I mean, of course, there's James Carville's famous quote about Pennsylvania. You got Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Appalachia in between. You could say that about Michigan or Ohio or all kinds of states. There's no state that's all cities, not even New York or California. There's a lot of folks in small towns and rural communities that are, they want to be represented too. They want to have their voices heard. And while I certainly think it's true that President Biden's policies and the Inflation Reduction Act have been positive and are leading to reinvestment, you also have to own up to the fact that NAFTA and bringing China into the World Trade Organization, those were Democratic policies. They were bipartisan policies, in fact, but had support from President Clinton and other Democrats. And there was a price to pay for the economic devastation that were caused by those kind of policies. And it's not just showing up, it's also showing up with something better.
Yeah, I'm going to push back a little bit on that, because I don't think those were Democratic policies. NAFTA was certainly not. It was birthed under Reagan, fully negotiated under H.W. Bush. Clinton got in at the end when it was already negotiated. He added some labor and environmental things. This was fully bipartisan. There was only one person in that 92 race who was opposed to it. And as the guy with the big ears who said you're going to have a giant sucking sound, who turned out to be right. What's kind of a little frustrating to me is everyone says these are Democratic principles. They're not. They were bipartisan. This is when we were truly bipartisan. And this is why I'm not a huge fan of bipartisanship.
Well, it was a bipartisan consensus to send jobs overseas, and we don't have to worry too much about manufacturing or economy will cover it in other sectors. And it's intriguing, in fact, to see at times when parties were really at loggerheads, that was the one thing they could agree on, is let's do more free trade.
Yeah.
And that's caused a lot of dislocation in the United States, and many communities are still paying the price. I think you're seeing some recovery now. And I personally am very excited about seeing them and that go into renewable energy and addressing climate at the same time as you're addressing the need for manufacturing and trying to help make sure that states like Michigan, where the auto industry is obviously still vital to our state, get to be part of the new industry and the newest high technology and 21st century jobs. But it's a challenge. And President Biden's tried to step up to that challenge, and Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are going to pick up that banner. We'll see how well they connect with rural and small town voters on these issues.
Yeah, but ultimately, I go back to and I think about, when we did our 22 tour, the people that we met said, look, the reality that rural voters were Democrats, they were Democrats in economic terms. Socially, they were still very conservative, but economically, they bought into a lot of the Democratic ideals. When you had strong unions in rural communities, strong labor support, strong Democratic support. Does what you're talking about equate to these rural communities rediscovering labor unions and and that kind of push, because these new jobs can come in, but if they don't pay decent wages, they don't have decent benefits, I don't know that you're making lives much better. And I guess the other part is, who gets credit for it?
Well, it's an open question. One, what happens, and two, how people perceive what happens. But certainly you're correct, just because a job is created doesn't mean it's a good job. But that's kind of up to working people in our unions. We got to go out there and organize. The government can push money in, but when the hiring happens and the plan opens and the jobs get there, what kind of jobs will they be? That's a fight that working people have to engage in. And you know, as well as anybody, you don't get anywheres without putting up fight. If they can, companies will pay the lowest wage and have a non-union setting, and that's what they like to do. So working people have to say something different and go out there and win those organizing campaigns.
Yeah.
So that a lot of that remains to be seen. Certainly under this administration, there's a view that union jobs and good paying jobs and jobs with healthcare and retirement security are an important part of how you rebuild the country. And that's a positive, but it's not all up to what the politicians in D.C. decide to do. It's up to what families decide to do in small towns in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan, and how do they react to these new jobs and new opportunities, and is that a broadly shared prosperity or another trickle-down setup where the investors are making a lot of money but the workers don't do very well? That's not predetermined. We're gonna have to fight that one out.
Yeah, and again, for me, it comes from the people who are at the top. And look, Biden has pushed this union promotion of unions like we're supposed to be doing under the NLRA. And I look at someone like Tim Walz, much like your governor, Whitmer, who when they got the keys to the steamroller, they knew how to drive it and they got stuff done. So for me, having Walz on the ticket is someone who I've been calling them get her done Democrats. We need people who are going to go in there and push the ideology and the policies of making people's lives better. And I'm hoping he's the guy who's going to be really behind pushing that.
Yeah, I mean, that's his track record in Minnesota. And he's somebody who ran in a purple district, so he had to appeal across the board. He has a reputation for working across the aisle when he was in Congress. A little bit different when he got to be a governor, but he's somebody who responds to his constituency. When he represented a red purple district, he reached across the aisle and had certain kind of policies. When he's governor of blue state, a little bit different. And he had a trifecta, and he certainly used the opportunities he had to push some very positive policies for workers and families. So he could be a good spokesman for that. Yeah. I do think, you know, it's the top of the ticket that matters the most. And Vice President Harris has had a tremendous rollout, one of the most well-executed launches to a campaign I've ever seen. You only get one chance to make a first impression. She's made a good one. So we'll see how that plays out in these communities and whether that continues. It's a compressed campaign, which probably a lot of people are going, thank goodness, it's going to be shorter. We won't have to listen to this for months and months and months. But it's a fight out there. President Trump Republicans aren't going away. They've got something to say on these issues, and they're going to duke it out for support in these communities and in the suburbs and so on. And it's going to be very interesting. It's been a very interesting 6 weeks, and I think it'll be a very interesting what's it going to be in the next 12 to 16 weeks as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the debates. Will be very interesting to see. But Roger, I appreciate you taking some time. Great piece. I hope folks will check out barnraisingmedia.com, where you can find Roger Kirsten's piece, Can Tim Walz Help Democrats Win Back Rural America? We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. Roger, appreciate the time, man.
Sure. Thank you, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Is it possible? Could it be possible that Democrats might actually bring back some rural voters, people like me? Can we do that? I think so. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. The act was a key piece of the president's New Deal, a series of federal programs responding to the ravages of the Great Depression. Social Security would provide an income for retirees and the disabled to ensure that they did not slide into complete destitution. On signing the bill, President Roosevelt, known for delivering memorable speeches, addressed the press. He said, quote, "Today, the hope of many years standing in large part fulfilled. the civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder, what will their lot when they come to old age? The man with a job has wondered how long that job will last. This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health. He went on to say, quote, "The law will flatten out the peaks and valleys of deflation and inflation. It is, in short, a law that will care of human needs and at the same time provide the United States an economic structure of vastly greater soundness." Over the past few decades, politicians have increasingly sounded the alarm that Social Security will not remain viable as the large baby boomer generation retires and draws benefits. Yet despite those who seek to attack Social Security, it remains a bedrock of the social safety net for millions of Americans. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So on Tuesday, the Teamsters National Black Caucus, they endorsed Kamala Harris and Tim Walz as president and vice president. Now, again, this is the Teamsters National Black Caucus, a segment of the Teamsters who have made this endorsement. It's not the Teamsters as a union. They have failed to endorse to this point. And general consensus among a lot of the people that I know and have and I respect don't believe an endorsement is going to come from the international. And it may. Look, there's a long time still till the election. It may come. It may come at the most strategic time. It may be something that's beneficial. But at this point, the consensus seems to be that no endorsement's coming because, well, the argument is divided. And no endorsement, it really is an endorsement for Trump, given the fact that O'Brien was at the RNC convention saying very, very glowing things about Trump and J.D. Vance. And it's interesting, you know, J.D. Vance was the right-wing love child for about, I don't know, 6 seconds. And now there's a lot of buyer's remorse because evidently there's some photos. There are always photos, aren't there? There's some photos floating around of JD in drag. What is it about conservatives that they do the things that they seem to say they hate? You know, what would make JD Vance dress up in drag? I've never done it. Not that there's anything wrong with it. You want to be a drag, go live your best life, but don't be a hypocrite about it. That's my problem. Don't be a hypocrite. And I think we're seeing a lot of the hypocrisy of the J.D. Vances of the world and the Trumps of the world and you know, this whole MAGA movement. Some good news coming out of Arizona. Their Secretary of State's office has confirmed that the abortion rights thing that, you know, seemed to be real important to folks going to be on the ballot in November there in Arizona. This could be a big driver. And again, one of those states that Democrats do need to win. So this could be a positive. Look, Florida's on the abortion's on the ballot in Florida. So is legalized marijuana. They're saying Florida may actually be in play this election. Florida may actually be in play. Kind of shows how far Trumpism is falling. And I think, understand, you know, I started today's show off talking about the interview that Trump did with Elon Musk, and it's bad. Save yourself the trouble. Just it's all rehash material, just in one long format of rambling and stuttering. But I think people are finally starting to tire a little bit. There's no optimism in Trump's speeches anymore. You know, in 2016, when he burst onto the scene, 2015, 16, he was talking about rebuilding manufacturing. He was talking about rebuilding middle-class lives. He was talking about those communities that have felt left behind. They actually felt heard, that their problems might be addressed by someone like Donald Trump. They weren't, and they never were going to be. There was never a plan. I don't think he had, I believe he never thought he was going to win. So it was just, hey, we're just talking stuff to get attention. Biden, on the other hand, has actually done a lot of really great stuff. And I look at the investments we're making in alternative energy. I just saw a story the other day that said in New Mexico, there's another big solar factory going to go in, some like $950 million investment by this Ebron Solar Company, which is a, you know, again, one of these big Singapore, you know, based chip manufacturer. They're a subsidiary of this Ebang International. And it seems that the chip making folks are going, hey, there's some interest in the U.S. to make solar cells. Maybe we invest in that. Now, this is the second company that is investing in that area. You had another big company that's going to spend, I think it was some over $1 billion was the last number I saw. It's this Singapore-based Maxeon Solar Technologies. They're going to employ about 1,800 people. That's going to create about 1,800 jobs. And then, you know, add all the construction jobs and all the interest in that area. You're now, that's going to be like Solar Central. And it's interesting, you know, as I saw the name of the place, it's Mesa del Sol. And this Mesa del Sol for Breaking Bad fans is where Breaking Bad's was filmed. And my mind goes, is it possible that, you know, that someone at these companies were Breaking Bad fans? I don't know, but it is interesting to me that all of this investment is going there. And then you go, wait a second. No, it's not Breaking Bad. Much as I love Breaking Bad, that's not it at all. It's the investment that were made. It's the investments that were made by the Biden administration. It was the investments made by the city of Albuquerque. It was the vision to say, we're going to create this, this area, this region that's going to take on this kind of technology. It's the industrial development area that they created and planned commercial, industrial, residential building around this Albuquerque area, which again is going to create the kind of jobs, the kind of future that we want to pass along to our kids and our grandkids. I think it's great. Here's my problem, though, and I'm sure you're going to know where I'm going to go with this. You got two Singapore companies coming in doing what we should be doing for ourselves here at home, because, you know, it seems like American manufacturers still have China on their mind. And it seems like, you know, a political party in this country, while all there's a lot of talk about how much we need to take on China, still kind of in that world. This is where, as a kid growing up in the 70s, when manufacturing in the U.S. was king, and we were the global leader in manufacturing, I'd love to see us be that again. I'd love to see those jobs that are being created in new technologies and visionary industries incubate, grow, and prosper right here for American workers. And not because, you know, I'm hyper patriotic, I am, but because those jobs are going to create opportunities for families to lead a better life. Those jobs could come with good wages, good benefits, health, retirement security, safe working conditions, opportunities, could pay taxes into the local school base so we have better schools, could demand we need better health care. There's so much positivity that could come out of a growing, massive industrial base. We just have to be smart enough to go, yeah, that's what we want. We just have to be smart enough to go, yes, please, more. Can we do more of this? And it's clear that Donald Trump doesn't have this at heart. It's clear that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, it's clear that they do. Why? Because they're picking up the mantle from Joe Biden. And as I said at the beginning, Joe Biden, I got to tell you, history is going to smile on Joseph Biden. Just my thoughts. I want to hear yours. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Missing any portion of the program? Grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, check Free Speech TV, freespeech.org, the website, for all of our video contents. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.